You're listening to All Things Considered on North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. I'm Jeff Tiberi. After a summer recess, we're back to reconvene our weekly political discussion, and there's plenty to talk about. Rob Schofield of the Progressive NC Policy Watch is here, so too is Becky Gray from the conservative John Locke Foundation. It's nice to see you both.
Good to see you,
too,
Jeff. Thanks. Happy summer.
We begin with the uncertainty pertaining to ballot questions. State lawmakers approved 6 changes to the state constitution earlier this year. Voters need to approve those in November. But 4 of the referenda are being challenged in court. 2 deal with executive powers. 1 relates to a voter ID requirement. And the 4th would lower the cap on state income tax. The governor, as well as the NAACP and Clean Air Carolina, have sued to try to block these questions from ever going before the voters. Part of their argument is that these questions are misleading and do not convey to voters what constitutional changes would actually follow. 5 former governors railed against the proposals to reduce executive authority this week. We now wait for the courts to render a decision. Becky, specific to the questions about executive power, are these changes really necessary?
That's a good question. And, you know, we've seen this struggle. This started before, actually, this started under Governor McCrory. I mean, we've had this question of the power between the gubernatorial executive branch and the legislative branch. Actually, it started with Jim Hunt, who was one of the 5 governors that was at this press conference this week on what is the power. You know, North Carolina was one of the latest states in the country to get the governor's veto. Mm-hmm. So this has been a struggle for all these years. This latest of who makes the appointments to the boards and commissions is really what is at the heart of this. And what the General Assembly is doing is they are transferring most of that power from the governor's office to them. So this is a big deal. This is a big change. And I think it's an important change for voters to consider in November.
I mean, this is a huge deal. The amendments are absurd and misleading. The language that, at least at this point, would appear on the ballot. I mean, surely there is a line somewhere in the sand. There's some line at which the language that appears on the ballot is so far different from what would actually happen if it were enacted that the courts have to step in. That's why I think they make a very compelling case that the courts do need to step in here. If we had an amendment that said it was about the state lottery, but buried in the fine print, it did away with the treasurer's office, surely the courts would weigh in and say that this violates some basic premise of our Constitution and of fair and open government. And in this case, that's clearly what's going on here. We've got an amendment. The one on judicial appointments quite arguably takes away the governor's right to veto bills. It could literally take away the governor's right to veto a lot of bills because it implies that if a bill includes a judicial appointment from the legislature, the governor can't veto that. Well, what's to stop the legislature from putting judicial appointments in all bills they don't want vetoed? I mean, that's a remarkable change in the balance of power. And to take hundreds of appointments away from the executive branch, the branch that's charged with enforcing law, implementing law, and shifting it over to the lawmaking branch, to the legislative branch, is another huge change. So big deal.
Becky, if not misleading, I think we probably could agree these questions are open-ended and include some vagueness. Do these go too far, as Rob just said? I mean, where is the line in the sand, and do the courts need to step in here?
Well, where's the line in the sand, and where's the responsibility to the voters? The language that will be on the ballot is the language that was in the bills that were passed through the General Assembly. So this is very simple. I mean, the language is not complicated. It's very simple, very easy to find.
And not all the language from the bills, from the amendments, is going to be on the ballot. I mean, not every single word.
Yes. I mean, the question that will come before the voters is part of each of the bills that were passed from the General Assembly.
You but
can
all
vote
of the
for
changes.
Or against. Well, for example, here's the language that will be on the ballot to vote for or against to establish a bipartisan board of ethics and elections to administer ethics and election laws, to clarify the appointment authority of the legislative and judicial branches, and to prohibit legislators from serving on boards and commissions exercising executive or judicial authority. That is exactly what will be on the ballot that we will vote
right,
for
sure
or against.
Enough.
Now, is that clear? Is it unclear? Is there a responsibility to the voter to do some homework to understand what this is? you know, I mean, that's the question. That's why it's being litigated through the courts. That's what Governor Cooper is suing over. You know, I mean, some people would say this is very clear. And one thing that you want to, I think, is important is when you amend the Constitution, you don't want a whole lot of language that muddies things up. You want it as clear and concise as it can be. Now, is this clear enough for every voter in North Carolina? I don't know the answer to that. What I do know is that voters have a responsibility to find out what this means, what their opinion on these things are. And we're certainly getting a lot of, I mean, the press is all over this. You can't turn on the radio. You can't turn on the television. You can't pick up a newspaper without all of this being discussed. So I think the notion that no voter in North Carolina has any information available to them is pretty disingenuous.
But transferring hundreds of appointment positions from the governor to the legislature, it's not clarifying it. And no reasonable person could read the word clarify and interpret that to mean transfer hundreds of people from the governor to the legislature. I mean, it's a blatant power grab that they're disguising by not saying what they're doing.
And
do you
voters
agree with that
have,
point? That we could use a different word than clarify. Clarify makes it seem as though this is a small change. This would be a significant shift of power.
This is a significant shift of power, yes. And therefore, I think, again, it comes back to there's a responsibility to each of us that are voting to decide how we're going to vote on this. Now, you know, I don't know how this is going to go down, whether people are going to think this is a good idea or not. I mean, that's what the voters are going to decide. That's what the intent of this was. In the past, we have seen there have been previous complaints about the clarity of the language for constitutional questions. There was one that had to do with tax increment financing a decade ago, that there was a lot of confusion about that. It ended up passing. The voters weighed in. We have to assume they did their homework before they voted. That was the will of the people to amend the Constitution, so that's what happened. So this whole notion that some people don't understand what the question is on the ballot is nothing new.
If this remains on the ballot, and if these are enacted, there will be legal challenges pertaining to the constitutionality of them for years to come. I'd note briefly that Governor Hunt talked about that, or excuse me, Governor Easley talked about the legal challenges. Governor Perdue, just to your last point, Becky, did talk about the confusion around all this. And she said, as a former governor, she has a hard time keeping up with what's really going on. Rob, I want to ask you about the five former governors who offered what was really this unprecedented rebuke on Monday. Could this really have an impact come November, or was this more of a spectacle?
No, I think it can have an impact. I thought Governor Jim Martin, who, you know, is widely respected, a former Republican governor, was very eloquent in saying, I believe he used the word deceitful. He said he was embarrassed that his party was behind this. It was, I thought, a remarkable, and the fact that Pat McCrory would stand up there, a person who himself signed legislation to take power away from Governor Cooper right before he took office, even he stood up there, couldn't believe the nature of this blatant power grab. And I think all five of the governors spoke very eloquently about the fact that this is deceptive language. It doesn't tell the voters. It gives no voter, who, unless that voter is going to go out and do a bunch of research on their own, an opportunity to just read the ballot and truly understand what the change is. That's a remarkably dishonest act by the General Assembly. And I think I was proud of Governor Martin, Governor McCrory, and others for calling him out.
I thought the fact that, you know, you had five former governors stand up united for something, I don't think it's a PR move. I don't think it's a gimmick. I think it's very genuine. But I think what you have is you have governors protecting gubernatorial turf against a threat that they see from the legislature infringing on that turf. They have every right to voice their opinion, First Amendment rights. I think it's very informative. I was delighted that there were, Jeff, I know you were there. The press was there. You all have done great reports on it. Others have as well. I think this is all part of that information and informing the public. And I know Governor Perdue in her remarks said something to the effect of, you know, they were going to move forward with it. They were going to formulate a plan, but they were not going to spend months and months raising tons of money and doing that kind of thing. And what I heard her saying there too is, you know, we all have a responsibility again. And I think the governors coming forward have exercised their responsibility. I agree with Rob. I think that's great.
That was Monday. The five governors gathered afterward. We heard about an amicus or an amicus brief that was filed. We're in web extra time here. You're an attorney, or you were an attorney. Amicus or amicus? Which one is it?
I think either one.
All right,
I answered
fine.
Either one. I always say amicus brief.
Tomato, tomato.
They filed an amicus brief to join the governor's lawsuit to try to halt some of these referenda questions from moving forward. So we are deeply in just a follow-up, web follow-up here. Mm-hmm. I was struck by the tone of Governor McCrory's stance on Monday. The other four seem to be talking a lot about executive powers. Governor McCrory seemed to be talking a lot about Pat McCrory, and also a little bit about executive powers. It felt and seemed and smelled like a stump speech to me. Meanwhile, today, as we record this on Thursday, Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest made his most firm statement yet on Twitter that he's going to run for governor in 2020. I'm wondering what both of you think the GOP should do about Pat McCrory, because it strikes me that this is a problem for the Republican Party in terms of, you don't want a bruising primary in which whoever wins, probably Forrest, because it's a more conservative race, is just going to spend a lot of money.
I think for any political party, and particularly for a race like the North Carolina governorship, you know, you never want a primary that's going to, like, eat up a lot of your donors' money and time, and the two candidates are going to beat each other up, and whoever wins is going to come out bloodied and poor. I mean, nobody wants that,
sure.
Whether it's Republicans,
so
Democrats,
having
you know, anybody.
On that, what do they do with Pat McCrory?
That's a good question. I don't know.
I want you to tell me what you think they should they try to give him an appointment? Should they just keep calling Donald Trump and say, get him in your
administration? Get him out of here. Get him out of North Carolina.
This is a problem for the Republicans. Is that fair or not?
A problem. It's a challenge.
Okay.
It's a challenge moving forward. Certainly a challenge for Dan Forrest. I mean, he would rather not have a primary. And Pat McCrory has not said whether or not he's going to run for governor. I agree with you. He keeps nudging towards that edge. I'm not sure, but you know what is the GOP going to do? I mean, the GOP notoriously has stayed out of primaries, and so whether they do some sort of behind the scenes arm twisting, I don't know.
I'd be surprised if powers that be in the Republican Party didn't try to dissuade Governor McCrory from running again. But you know, I honestly think that Cooper would rather run against Forrest than McCrory. I think he
Agreed.
Is going to easily be able to portray Forrest as an extremist, who's given voice to all kinds of absurd, extreme far-right views on everything from religion to women's rights, you name it, LGBT rights. Whereas McCrory is sort of the ultimate chameleon. He's won in 2008, he ran as a moderate, 2012, he ran as a conservative, 2016, kind of both. This would be four straight times he'd be running for governor. I guess he's batting 333. But, you know, I actually think that Cooper would rather run against Forrest.
All right. Moving on, U.S. House races. The nonpartisan Cook Political Report moved North Carolina's 9th congressional district into its toss-up category. It's an open seat in a district that is +9 for Republicans. Dan McCready is the Democrat. Mark Harris is the Republican. Nationally, listeners will remember that Democrats are attempting to take 23 seats from Republicans and power of that chamber. Rob, what does the competitive nature of this race, the 9th, outside of Charlotte, tell you about the larger picture?
Well, I mean, the picture has been clarifying now, really ever since Donald Trump became president, that Democrats and progressives and a lot of progressive-leaning independents are very mobilized, energized. They want to send a message to Trump. They want to take any kind of action they can. This is really going to be their first national opportunity to strike back against a president that they see as an embarrassment to the country. And so they're going to be very, very energized. And I think this is exactly what we'd expect. A president in the first off-year election after becoming president, their party typically suffers anyway. And we know Trump's poll numbers are terrible. But it's difficult for the Republicans because they still have a solid core of Trump loyalists within the party who control the primaries. So that's why we have Mark Harris, who's even much more extreme to the right than Robert Pittenger, who he displaced. So it's Dan McCready is a formidable candidate, an ex-Marine, attractive. He's got a lot of funding, and I think he's emblematic of a lot of races around the country.
You mentioned the Cook Political Report had moved this. I think it's interesting. Of the 7 major groups that do these ratings, 5 of them have moved this race to toss-up.
Right, 538 as well.
Right, I think 538 earlier this week came out with that. One group has them as tilt Republican. The New York Times has it as a lean Republican. So of the competitive districts in North Carolina that we're looking at it all, this does seem to be the one that is the most toss-up at this point. I think it's interesting that nationally, and Jeff, I think you even posted something on Twitter this week to this effect, that nationally, Republicans and Democrats are not really all singing from the same song sheet, that you're seeing these races become much more localized. And I think with some of the primary results that we're seeing, some other things around the country that we've seen, the indication seems to be if there is a blue wave, there will be lots of hues of that blue wave, and it's more of a regional thing. You know, the Democrats have problems, too. I mean, one of the Nancy Pelosi's popularity rating, I mean, a lot of the candidates are really dismissing them, making pledges they will not vote for her if they're elected. So there's problems on both political parties. The thing that I think is really interesting about this ninth congressional race in North Carolina is Dan McGreedy is a very moderate candidate. He is very much, I think, a good candidate for that district. He's a former military person. He's moderate. He's young, good-looking, mm-hmm. you know, all of those things. But I think that he has, and I'm not suggesting that he's changed his stripes for any reason, but I think that he is a very moderate, he's a good candidate for that district.
Absolutely.
Probably wouldn't be the best candidate to run against, like Ted Budd, in a district just a short way away from that. And I think you're seeing that across the country, where these candidates are really designing themselves for what that district is. And so rather than a blue huge wave, I think we're going to see ripples all over the country with different hues of blue, red, pink, that kind of thing.
It's only worth noting that in North Carolina, of course, we remain, our districts for congressional races remain absurdly gerrymandered. So the reason it's partially true that he's running more as a moderate, because this is a gerrymandered district. It is designed to elect Republicans, as are the vast majority of districts in North Carolina, even though there are more Democrats than Republicans.
Finally, about 350 newspaper editorials criticized President Donald Trump for his frequent and more recently heightened attacks on the American press. The LA Times did not join the effort yesterday, its editorial board writing in part, "The idea of joining together to protest him seems almost to encourage that kind of conspiracy thinking by the president and his loyalists. Why give them ammunition to scream about collusion?" End quote. What is the best way for the press to respond or ignore the leader of this country, Becky?
You know, I sort of have to side with the LA Times position on this, to be honest with you. I think independent newspaper voices are important when they all come together with sort of a united message. I think, you know, it could certainly dilute that message. So I think I'd kind of side with the LA Times. The independence of the newspapers, and, you know, the John Lott Foundation has Carolina Journal, and that's one thing that we really try to do is be independent from other news sources and have our own voice. And I think with that, with this, I kind of agree with their criticism that perhaps it just draws more attention to Trump and his treatment of the media if there's a mass effort against it, where maybe individual responses at appropriate times might be more effective.
I mean, this to me, it's not unlike the governors coming together. It's a united front of papers that are right, left, and the middle in an extraordinary moment in American history. These moments are rare, but we are at a moment in which the president of the United States is a scoundrel and a liar and someone who has a public enemies list makes Richard Nixon, who was himself a scoundrel, look like a statesman. A couple weeks ago, I guess a month or so ago, I was in Washington. I happened to be in the Museum of News in Washington, D.C., on the day that reporters were murdered at the newspaper in Annapolis, and happened to just be standing there in front of an exhibit put up to the memory of murdered journalists. And I think it's fair to say that President Trump is continuing to contribute to an environment in which journalists are literally at risk in our country for reporting the news. And I don't blame the papers for standing up to that. I think the LA Times is just trying to say the same thing in a different way.
Becky Gray is Senior Vice President with the John Locke Foundation. Rob Schofield is Director of NC Policy Watch. Enjoy your weekend.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks, Jeff.